Thank you, Peter. We have time for questions, and Carl will bring the microphone by. How about the lady right here?
I wish the panel had been a little bit more balanced. I found it very much on the right. And I just want to mention that there are words you said nothing about.
By the way, one question. Was Bismarck right-wing or left-wing?
I'm just commenting about contemporary politics. There are languages other than the market for assessing policy questions, for assessing what is to be done. I'm not saying the Oakland schools are in great shape, but I work there all the time as a researcher, and so does my colleague here. And I don't think the two of you have spent very much time on the ground where the battles are being fought.
Do you have a question?
Here's my question. What about democracy and the history of the ideal, at least, of the common school, in which children from varied backgrounds, not just immigrants, but social class has not been mentioned here, would come together and learn democratic discourses and citizenship? What about the ideal of a sense of the public and of children as a collective responsibility and resource? What about questions of inequality? We have wider income gaps now than ever before in U.S. history. So my question is the following. Since the Reagan era, public provisioning for families, for caregiving, and for public services have deteriorated radically, funding for parks and rec as well as schools, for example. And market dynamics have expanded. There are some areas of the world, and issues of care and education are some of them, where markets don't work as well as they may, for example, in manufacturing. And my question is, what about these wide inequalities? And if you were to have a total market mechanism, as you are proposing, what would happen to the 25% of children in Oakland who live below the poverty line, 35% in L.A. County? The rich always get richer.
They go to functional schools.
I don't think that would be the case. I'd like you to address inequality and justice and democracy issues.
Sure. Go ahead. John,
well, I mean, I don't really know what the question is, but there's nothing worse for poor children than the system that we have now.
I think the question is a fine illustration of what I said about the way in which educators think. I mean, essentially, they don't view education as a business or an industry, they view it as a religion. As you know, I mean, as some of you know here, the fact is that public schools are a relatively recent invention in the U.S. They're not more than about just over 100 years old. For most of the first 100 years of the Republic, they weren't the Republic, they weren't public schools, they were private schools. And they seem to be pretty good about being democratic. So I'm inclined to think that these things can be delivered. But you know, we're not talking here about a pure market system. We're talking about a system which is a very substantial government subsidy to students, amounting, as John says, to somewhere up to $8,000 a year. That subsidy exists. The question is, what's the most efficient way to deliver it?
By the way, one book you might want to consult is a book by Joel Spring called Education in the Corporate State, which is basically about essentially how the state system is essentially designed to turn out cogs in the corporate state wheel for military adventurous purposes, which is not exactly a right-wing position. Other questions?
Just one other thing about the battles she's fighting. The whole idea of this is not have those battles. Most school things can be decided individually between parent and school proprietor. We don't all have to agree on what should be taught and how it should be taught.
Well, yes, I just did address it.
Sure,
if
we
have said those are substantial substitute to every student who's in the public schools. That's right. It's a question of what is the most. The problem is most of that subsidy right now goes to salaries, and it maybe should be spent some other way.
Oh, yeah, right.
There's also, I think, there's a certain question about whether collectivism and equality can go hand in hand, or whether it's basically a system of an elite ruling the masses and forcing them to participate, whether they have any choice or not.
I may be unique here. I have attended private and public school. I have homeschooled. I have children who went to private school and children who went to public school. So I've done it all. And I must say that I'm very impressed with both of you two gentlemen and all that you had to say. I also serve on the school board in my district, and I deal with collective bargaining in a very real state, and it's horrible. I did not realize how difficult it was to deal with the teachers union until I arrived with a majority of teachers union supporters on my board. My question is, you said that Texas was able to get rid of collective bargaining and that they have gotten rid of compulsory fees, or that they have a profit-making institution that fights on behalf of the teachers. Is that correct? Did I understand that correctly? And how can we in California get rid of collective bargaining? Right now it's almost impossible with the Democratic-controlled legislature and governor who's passing almost every bill they can. We deal with about 500 education bills last year, at least, that they passed for us to deal with in education. So it's an overwhelming task for us. But I want to hear how we in this room, and including board members, what can we do to, because there's another person that's on the school board with me that came. How can we get rid of collective bargaining?
Before Peter answers that, let me just point out the contrast between these two. She's talking about battles. I mean, she just named them. How can we survive in a system where we pass 500 new pieces of legislation? Of course those are battles, and that's exactly what's destroying our school system. The whole idea is to avoid that. Sorry. She addressed her question.
Texas is a state where there is not collective, there are no collective bargaining laws, and there are no agency fee laws. So it's more or less you can't strike as a teacher. So the union is very weak in terms of its legal power. And there's a very large Texas Independent Educators Association, which is not a union. What I think you were thinking of was North Carolina and Virginia, where laws have been passed that actually prohibit the state. Prohibit the school boards from engaging in collective bargaining with the union. As to what can be done here, you know, it's really just a mirror image of what happened in the 1980s when they put collective bargaining through. I mean, most people don't even know what collective bargaining is. It has to be identified as the enemy. It has to be made into a political issue. That means that whoever does it, for example, the Republican Party, is going to have to show some backbone, which is a problem. On the other hand, I grew up as a kid in England where all the major industries were nationalised, and they're now denationalised, and none of us expected that to happen. It was just done because there was a strong political leader, and because the economy was cratering, and the education system is cratering, so we just need some political leadership, and I recommend that you provide it.
Wait a second.
This teacher, I have to thank her for bringing up a term, democratization. I have a real issue with that term in education because I've done all private school, public school, homeschool. And my goal as a parent is to nourish my children's mind and intellects. And I'm really more concerned about civilizing my children instead of socializing them, which goes along with democratization. Because socializing is to put them under the control of the government.
Do you have a question?
And so I'm wondering, that's my point of view. But when I go out and I talk about school choice, having written the School Choice Initiative with Milton Friedman, I find that there are so many people that don't even have a concept of what education is. There is no definition. And isn't that one of the first problems we have to attack? What is education and by whose standard are we going to go along? Isn't it, in the end, going to have to be the parents who decide what the standard is for their children?
Right, that's right. We don't want to politically decide that question. We want to leave that up to individual families.
I mean, if
we can't politically decide it, it's not going to happen.
I mean, people, by and large, who are interested in the concept of democracy in education or any field want, basically, to have a system that's responsive, that's accountable, that they have a say in, that is functional, and is one that will reinforce the bonds of cooperation and community and so on and so forth. Does the system do that? That's the question. How about the gentleman right here?
Please don't throw hard objects, but I am a union steward. and I have the distinction of going to one of the worst school districts in probably the country, the Richmond Unified School District, and one of the best in Benicia, California. So I've seen both sides of the coin. And I have a three-part question. I think you both gave a pretty cogent explanation of the problem, but your solutions were pretty far off. As far as the union, one possibility you didn't consider, what do you think of union empowerment? Because I think it's a kind of a tired old fallacy that you trotted out that the unions are these all-powerful organizations who are controlling the weather and everything else. They're actually not very powerful, especially on a local level. My wife is a teacher, and she she has no control over what goes on in the classroom. Things are fiated to her by the school district, not by the union. And the solution I've seen from going to a very poor school district is the problem with our school system, I can speak firsthand, is the peer culture in the school, and it's not the teachers. Yet teachers have gone to school for an average of 5 years. How would you deal with the peer culture? That's one question. And would you advocate empowering teachers to kick out the one or two students in every classroom, even in the good districts that take up all the teachers' time? The second part of my question is, how could you please, especially Mr. Brimelow, if you could explain to me, how does spreading yet more taxpayer money to the private sector instead of just the public sector, how does that increase the sort of capitalist laissez-faire system that you seem to be promoting? And my third part is, the union. How would the further empowerment of the union and the union being given a chance hurt these reforms? You might not actually have the enemy you think you have.
I'm not sure what you mean exactly by union empowerment, but in terms of actually, as I said earlier, I do think that it's a big problem for the system that is trying to keep too many kids in school too long who should perhaps be out somewhere else. And that goes to the compulsory attendance laws, which and the length of time they require kids to stay in school. I think that we should definitely be looking at that. I don't know that this is what the union wants, though. It seems to me they want people to stay in school because they want more clients. I've never seen a union representative advocate that the school attendance be actually reduced. Now, your other question, it's just a question of economics here. We have here a subsidy that's delivered by the state to students, and at the moment is delivered in the form of government-owned buildings and curriculum, run curriculum and so on. This is the direct equivalent of giving, instead of giving food stamps to the poor, having free government-owned supermarkets. It would not be efficient. It's more efficient to have food stamps and let the supermarkets compete for them. That's the essential argument for vouchers. There is a tax subsidy given by the state, the question is what is the most efficient way to deliver it.
Interesting contrast. You pointed out they're not so powerful. They're powerful enough to keep the politicians making the choices and the policies, but it's true the politicians keep making bad choices and policies, which you described. That's the problem.
Can I just add, I agree completely with you. You see, the unions are not the whole problem in education. There are lots of other problems. The system is not short of problems. and one of the problems, you see this in Virginia. I mean, Virginia is a government-run school system. And the ethos of the government school system pervades Virginia, even though, the school boards there have a lot more power than they do elsewhere. This is a phenomenon. The National Right to Work people say that. They've talked to employers about unionization. And in heavily unionized states, or for example in Britain where I come from, you get the phenomenon of employers who've kind of become like pit ponies, They never see the light of day. They don't know what it is to be free. And they'll say things like, if we didn't have unions, how would we set wages? So the government school system itself is a pervasive problem and would be a problem, regardless of the existence of the union. There are other problems. So removing the union is not a weakening the union is not a panacea, but it is a prerequisite.
There are a number of writers like Ivan Illich and others who have raised the question of whether compulsory education laws are actually state-sponsored child labor. This lady right here.
It's not, the unions aren't the problem. They're blocking change. That's the problem.
What I have,
the political process is the problem.
What other stakeholder in a big bureaucracy is going to block change?
That's the point.
What I have seen is that there has been a lot of power structure, not so much with the teachers' union, they have a lot of power, but also the superintendents' association, the school board associations. These folks have a lot of power because when you talk to the rank and file teachers, oftentimes they don't agree with what's going on at the upper end of the teachers' unions. And a lot of the money that's in the educational system, which is over 55% of the state budget right now, does not get into the classroom. So I think our biggest thing that we can attack the public government schools with is that so much of the dollar goes to the bureaucracy, the overhead, and not the one-to-one, you know, teaching ratio. So I think that's where we have to attack this. So the teachers' union, the rank and file, is not that powerful. It's the superintendents. I have a friend that works for the California State Teachers Retirement System. People are retiring with millions of dollars from teaching, you know, or from being a bean counter in the district office, and that's got to change. And I think if those facts get out there, that will influence a lot of people. Thank you.
Could I just slightly change the one of the points that she was making and raise a question for both panelists? Was, if you didn't have compulsory funding of schools, what would happen to the collective bargaining nature of the union's power? Any thought about that? In other words, if people were not compelled to fund public schools, what would happen to the nature of the union participation?
Well, anything that interjected freedom into the system, where the teachers are all treated the same, the union would be destroyed.
This gentleman.
I am making the assumption that you. You people have your finger on the pulse of this thing, at least more than I do. Can you can you gaze in your crystal balls and tell me what the legal climate of homeschooling might be? I mean, they're under assault from the homeschool or from the teacher trust or the whole institutional thing, but at the same time they seem to serve as a safety valve also for kids that just can't fit in the one size fits all education system. So, but will they survive? And what is the future of homeschooling from a legal perspective? And how are the laws going in that, if anyone, in either one?
I'm afraid I'm not qualified. Okay. I'm not sure.
My impression is that homeschool. There have been battles fought in almost every state on this right. question. And essentially, the homeschools have won. They have been able to compel the authorities to recognize that this homeschools is legitimate. And they've done it for a bunch of reasons, but one of the best reasons is that they're organized. They're highly organized, use the internet a lot, and they were just a very well organized minority. And the evidence is that more and more people are going into it.
The one thing you haven't mentioned is parent involvement. And I was wondering if you could address. The one thing you haven't talked about is parent involvement. And I'm a perfect example of that, having. I lived in San Francisco and moved out because I thought the public schools were so terrible and I couldn't afford private schools. I went to Orinda, where the public schools are excellent and the children have done well. That's because we're very, very, very involved. So what do you think about the parent involvement forcing the changes that you want?
Well, parent involvement is discouraged by our current system. I agree with you. Parent involvement is an important ingredient. But if we involve parents in choosing schools and matching children to programs and that can't help but create additional involvement. We definitely need that. Peter, you want to add anything to that?
How about that, John?
Hello, this is an interesting question, Mr. Brimelow and John could mention. I'd work as a teacher. I've worked in the juvenile hall system for a while, and I come across some 16-year-old kids who commit crimes, go to juvenile hall, we find out that they have disruptive, dysfunctional families, and etc. They need counseling and all these other things. And yet I've also met 16-year-old kids who are bored and troublesome in high school and they want to drop out and they'd like to join the military where they might be able to come into under the government wing and get all these services also. but our present system does not allow that. So what's wrong with this picture, and how can we fix it?
Well, I think we described that as to give them some choice in doing some of these things. I don't think there's any reason to force all these, to force one size. I mean, one size doesn't fit all. You can't expect to put children from across the spectrum in one school, much less one classroom. For instance, these discipline problem children, they should have special services in a school specialized to handle that problem. They shouldn't poison classrooms across the system by being in there and disrupting and occupying all the teacher's time. No one teacher, a few miracle workers are out there, are talented enough to be able to be just that right person across the spectrum of children's interests and needs.
Thank you. Have either of you taken a look at the ratio of dollars spent for special education versus the rest of the education population and how that affects the outcome?
I haven't looked at that per se, but I know that a choiceless system like we have greatly magnifies the perception that there are special education problems. A system of diverse schools that are specialized where parents would choose would drastically reduce the number of children that sought to have themselves or their parents sought to have them labeled in some way, or schools that thought to have them labeled to get some more money from them.
I have some data on that at work, and it's expensive, and it's a major factor in the increase of cost, increase in the decline of productivity of the system.
I mentioned the Oakland schools originally, so that's a major problem.
What I really need to know is if it's having an effect on the outcome of the education of the rest of the children.
Mm-hmm. Mainstreaming is a disaster.
Gotten so far out of kilter.
Well, we know that the results the rest of children received are producing are not great. So something's doing it. So that's not a bad candidate.
Hi. Some of the work that I do with a group of people is working with these special students, and the parents choose in our system to come to our services through the public schools. So my question is, are you familiar with or do you know of any agencies out there that are currently working with the public schools so parents are choosing its services, fee for services in the public schools, parents have a choice? Are there any other organizations out there that you're familiar with that with special needs kids that parents have financial ability to choose in a public school?
Isn't this? I think there's some provision in No Child Left Behind for that, isn't there? They have a list of.
A supplemental service provider list that, but none of them are pretty much in the public schools. None of the service providers on that list have gone through in the state of California a series of exam questions, and then your allowed to come into the system, and you're given a certain amount of money. It runs between $400 and $1,200 per student if the school allows you in. Most schools, Sylvan, Kumon, Kaplan, other institutions, individuals who run counseling centers, these are the some of them that are on the supplemental service provider list for California.
And that's growing.
Oh, it's huge. It's growing. Yeah.
I remember an article a few years ago by Janet Beal, and she's in an organization around here. I can't remember which one it is.
Yeah, she was with Reasonful. I'm not sure.
Okay,
She's independent now.
Okay. She wrote an article about all of the children sent by choice by the public school officials to private schools specialized in particular special needs.
And so the school system paid for it.
The school system paid for it.
Where was this?
It was a couple of years ago in a newspaper, Wall Street Journal or something. But if you get a hold of her,
but no pervasive,
David sounds like he knows where she can be found.
Programs that are currently
No
pervasive programs that are currently taking some foothold for parent choice.
Not that I know of. That doesn't mean that. That's not just not
about,
area that
how
I
about in the back here, Carl?
Try to get a hold of her. She sounds like she's in that area.
Well, I run a private school myself, and we have a teacher at our school who is French. And so I have a question for Peter in particular, namely that the French left is very different from the American left in the sense that they want higher standards. They say that they don't want poor people to be exploited by the rich because the poor people are ignorant. Why do we see so much demand for lower standards on the part of the American left? Is there any chance of reversing that so that they're going for higher standards for the poor so that the poor don't get exploited and that competition might be a part of that?
How long do we have?
The short answer to that is we need to get the standard setting out of the political process. That shouldn't be a political issue.
Well, there is. The question you're raising about the American left is an extremely interesting one, but it's going to take. It's not easy to answer. It depends what you think their motives are, and the American left is not rooted in the working class. It's an elite left. Whereas I would say the French and to some extent the British left traditionally came out of the labor movement and so on, and actually had the working class, the interest of the working class at heart and cared about the working class. It's not clear that's the case in the American left. It's an elite left. That's equally true in Britain, by the way. Now, the education reforms that the socialists put through during the war in the coalition government were highly competitive and highly examination driven and IQ driven. And they developed a highly efficient system of socialism, but it was based on selectivity and on competition.
And also, the imposition of the public school system on what was a common school system, actually it was a combination of common schools and other schools in the U.S., was imposed by wealthier people on poor immigrants and so forth. Dick, did you have a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Given the current system, would you and how modify the current taxation system and the distribution of the taxation to the different schools, private and as well as religious and public?
Well, I haven't thought about that as much. Currently, what we need to do is we need to voucherize the existing funding, or tax creditize it, if you wish. But at some point, it would help to unify the funding and not have it be some mixture of federal, state, and local. Frankly, I think we need to get away from income taxes, so it probably ought to be some kind of a sales tax. And property taxes as well.
I just wanted to comment on the special ed. Someone asked about that. This Saturday, Hayward Unified is having a board meeting, and they're going to vote potentially to abandon class size reduction. And they have 340 some K through 3 classes. That would increase class size from 20 to 32 in a difficult district with a lot of multi-ethnic problems in terms of teaching, reading, what have you. And there in this district, there's an encroachment over $2 million of the special ed into the regular fund. Other districts, I'm told, in Berkeley had $9 million. It's, in Oakland, it's even larger. But it seems to be almost an entitlement of writing IEPs, learning disabilities. We have lots of autistic, and they're very expensive, and Hayward's doing a good job attracting more autistic. I don't know where they're coming from. But there's no limit to this. The district seems to be afraid of the lawsuits. And so imagine giving up class size reduction in 144 classes for little first graders, kindergartners, because of this thing is out of control that the district is not willing to take on. So it's a real crisis with regard to special ed.
Lady with
A couple of questions. And just in terms of historical perspective, it seems to me, and I'm sure you could correct, but that the compulsory attendance laws were put in place because of demands of the labor market, so because the children were working in the factories, and so to open the jobs for adult males, that was one of the things. And it seems to me that looking outside the box in a way, that if you were to change that, for the demands of our economy today, that would be one question I would have for you. And the other question is, in terms of your political constituencies, it seems that you get interested in education when you have children, and you're interested until they're done, and then you're not interested anymore. And so you have a fluctuating base, and yet the institution remains, and the teachers remain, and the bureaucrats remain. So they have much more of they're able to have a much more stable sort of lobbying effort. And then the other question is that my mother taught in Louisiana for 38 years, and
they didn't have unions. And so, I mean, when she was in school, you couldn't even chew gum, much less would they tell you who to marry, because teachers had to uphold a certain, and it was religious, about what they were. It was a calling. It was not just a job. But it seems to me that somehow, if you don't have collective bargaining, how do you address, what do the teachers do in their own economic interest, which would seem to be in line with this institute's mandate. And, you know, I have cousins who teach in private schools. They have no retirement. They get lower wages. And so you've got, I can understand your position about that, but what do you put in place of that? Because I don't think that any teacher would, you know, that's their economic self-interest is at stake. They're not going to go for that. And if you do want to enact this kind of change, what you have to offer something else, I would believe. Well, so those are my three areas.
Teachers would certainly see improved working conditions, whether they would see improved salaries would depend on how many former teachers would come back into the system after teaching became a profession again, as opposed to more of a blue-collar union occupation that it is now. So I don't see any problem in setting wages for true professionals that work with clients that choose them and specialize in areas according to wage differentials and sell themselves as productive team player teachers and that somebody would want to hire. And I know the principals want to be involved in hiring teachers, and that's the way it needs to happen, not school cartels called districts hiring teachers. The teachers need to be in a labor market where they can choose the school that they work in, not the district that they work in, and where they can shop themselves directly among competing schools, public or private.
I agree that it's true that most people get into education when they have children. But one of the points I'm making in my book is that you have to look at the cost dimension. In other words, people should be interested in education because they're taxpayers. Mm-hmm. That's what's really impacting most people. I mean, education is not a trivial cost in this country. And it really does drive state and local spending. And anybody who's concerned about taxes should look to that. Your point about the interest for teachers, of course, wages do get set in the private sector through a variety of ways, and for teachers that they should have these options too. As I say, in Texas there is one organization which is a profit-making entity that bargains on behalf of teachers. It's basically like having an agent, a literary agent or something. Another suggestion that I examine in this book is that we could move to a European model where you have competing unions. You don't have exclusive rep, you can have several different unions. More generally, though, I think the point you're making about the interest of the teachers in the current system is a very good one. One of the experience, the lessons of the privatization movement in Britain, when they did substantially privatize the nationalized sector, which was very, very large, is that however much it may distress you, you basically have to bribe the people who are in the system to give up their current position. And they did it in the case of privatization of water boards and electricity and so on by giving the workers shares. And that worked very well. It broke the workers' objection to it. And we have to find some similar equivalent to buy out the entrenched interests in the education system.
We don't want to judge a choice-based system on the basis of the private sector, the depravity of the private sector that we have now, because the private schools are now in a situation where it's a miracle that there are any private schools. By the way, I appreciate you and the fact that you've been able to perform this miracle. But try to think of another part of our economy where somebody can sell something for thousands of dollars that someone else is giving away. Pretty tough.
On the issue, by the way, of the historical background of compulsory education, if you go back and look at the writings of the people who were proponents of it, you'll find that it was very xenophobic, very racist, very ethnocentric, and you combine that with the fact that it was a lot of people didn't like. They wanted to essentially reduce the labor market. It's true. They wanted to eliminate young people being in the labor market, which is part of the continuum in other ways too. That's also how apartheid started too. How about this gentleman here?
Thanks, Carl. I was a teacher for 20 years, and the prevailing outlook of my colleagues was all we ask is less work to do and higher pay when we don't get it done. It was a disgusting period of time. I was in the classroom for 20 years. In the district where I live, the teacher union orchestrated the school board election in 1990 and won an award from CTA for doing so. CTA gives the Joyce Fottom Award for excellence in manipulation of school board elections. As far as democratization in the Oakland City schools is concerned, Ebonics is the model of democratization in the Oakland City schools. Question, and I know I need to ask a question.
Well, thank you for that comment. We appreciate that.
There are some who say that dumbing down of American education is rather deliberate, that there are forces from Lou Gerstner of IBM to Mark Tucker of the Carnegie Foundation to Hillary Clinton who have in view an American workforce that is pliant, that is a blank slate, that can be pretty much manipulated into whatever position is needed. Have you had any experience, any dealings with that movement? Can you talk about that for a moment?
This sounds like the kind of thing that would interest David to me.
I haven't, but I know that it's certainly easier to sustain a system like the one we have when there isn't any understanding of economics, and certainly we've achieved that.
If the purpose of education is that every individual matures and is able to think for him or herself and understand the world and function successfully, the model that you're mentioning, which is the mainstream model, is the opposite. I mean, it's to dumb down the quality, is to make people think alike, it's to make people subservient and basically submissive to the system. And that was one of the reasons, I'm not sure if you know about the story of the Pledge of Allegiance, but one of the major advocates of compulsory education was a guy named Bellamy who wrote the Pledge of Allegiance. And he was a Christian socialist, and he believed very strongly that you had to mold the citizenry, the young people, into being essentially loyal subjects of the national government. And there's a whole story about the practice of reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, actually raising your arm up, and there's a whole thing he wrote about this, which he got adopted throughout the country. And it's part of this model of what is education to essentially great sort of robot-type figures that will be subservient, or is to create individual, independent, self-acting people.
This is kind of a general question. Maybe some of the audience could answer it. In the Alameda County school system, my grandson's seen the movie Malcolm X 3 times, and he's getting kind of bored with it. Does anyone have any idea what the film budget is in Alameda County among the various school districts?
Our researcher has left.
Well, it sounds like they're pretty efficient. They have one film and they just keep showing them.
At least they're not spending a lot of money on films. And
they
could show, you know, three versions that are like Malcolm X, but different, so
they'd
have to buy three films. So. One more question. Did you have a...
Oh, I was going to respond to that woman earlier who was just... Left. No, this one here. That was discussing the need of unions to protect the teachers' paychecks and so forth. And... The personal experience I have, I live out in Lafayette in what is reputed to be a pretty good school district, and it probably is, and some of the best teachers have gotten together and formed a private academy after school, during which time they go back and repeat the day's lessons, and we send our kids there at roughly $25 per student per hour to get the lesson they didn't get in school. Now, why they didn't get it in school, I don't know. But in order for them to be able to graduate at the top of their class, pass their SATs, and get into college, we add this on top of whatever the hell we're paying in Lafayette for property taxes, which I don't even want to talk about. So, yes, the unions do defend some of the teachers, the ones we probably would be better off without.
Any comments? Or? Okay. Well, I want to thank our speakers, Peter Brimelow and John Merrifield. I want to thank you for joining with us. For those of you who have not picked up copies of their books, I hope you will do so. They're available upstairs. They'd be happy to autograph copies. And we hope to see you at our next independent policy forum. Thank you. Good night.